This is the Freedom Fiends. We are broadcasting from Pod Bay 4B, a mile above sea level at Intergalactic Prairie Studios South. We alter your locus coeruleus by warming your synapses with rejuvenative radio waves. This warms your brain to a tasty and toasty 365 degrees Fahrenheit to keep a sin flood of statism out of your head. Can you feel it working? Bill, are you with me?
I'm right here. I'm ready to sit with my colleague and very good friend to philosophically terraform the planet, one disobedient serf, Adam on the Fiends.
And the Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT no-gov license. This allows reuse by anyone except government. And you can learn more at BIPCOT.org. That's BIPCOT.org. And Bill and I are speaking over Fiend Phone, separated by about 8,000 miles of distance and probably a mile in elevation, at least maybe 2 miles in elevation difference. And because I'm almost sea level, I'm about 14 feet above sea level. And in addition to all that, we're bouncing the signal off of several satellites to get it across the internet, both between the GCN studios and Bill's secret location and my location on the Gulf of Mexico. So if you hear any dropouts or delays or whatever, that's why. We're bouncing off tin cans and through old radio receivers and bouncing off satellites around the world to bring you the Freedom Fiends today.
Now, are you telling me that Michael did not launch via Virgin Galactic Worm 1 to go up there so he has his own satellite constellation? That hasn't happened yet?
Oh, well, they're working on it. They're still working on it.
Okay, good, good, good.
So one of the things, we might as well just jump right into it here. One of the things that Bill and I wanted to talk about, we tend to, on the Freedom Fiends, we tend to keep things lighthearted and a lot of laughter and goofing around. And one of our mottos is that we're laughing while Western civilization collapses, or, you know, and we're throwing gasoline on the fires of Western civilization and sort of dancing around like a crazed Nero at times. But sometimes we decide to just be a little bit more serious and talk about some things. So today we wanted to touch on something that is maybe misunderstood quite a bit by people, but it's really not that complicated if you just understand the concept, and that is a black swan. And so what is a black swan? Well, a black swan doesn't necessarily mean there's a conspiracy theory afloat, and there's like guys with cloven hooves, and they're hiding in the mountains of, you know, between France and Switzerland and in a chalet, and they're planning out secrets of the world, and they're using, you know, black swans to control all of our minds. And that's not at all what a black swan is. It literally comes from the idea that sometimes it just happens that a group of swans that are all producing normal white-colored swans will sometimes produce an off-colored swan. It's just a thing that happens in nature. Sometimes a group of, you know, black cattle will produce one white cattle. It just happens sometimes. So a black swan, by definition, is an event that either nobody was expecting or very few people were expecting, but the ones who were expecting it were pretty much ignored by the general public, or at least by the powers that be. Is that a fairly good, is that a fairly acceptable definition to you, Bill?
I think it is. And for those who attend a Catholic high school, when I use the phrase, time, and we say, oh, that happened because of the following things. Well, that's the pleasure of hindsight. A black swan is an incredibly rare event where, when you look back on it in hindsight, one can forensically detect why it happened, maybe correlatively, better yet, causatively. But causation demands a much higher level of an evidentiary bar than correlation does. Now, The Black Swan was a book that was written by a guy by the name of Nassim Nicholas Taleb, who's a philosopher of science, a philosopher of history, and a trader, T-R-A-D-E-R, a trader in the stocks, commodities, things like that, since he has retired from that because he finds it so objectionable and the whole system so objectionable he no longer does it. This is part of a trilogy put together called the Incerto series. It was The Black Swan, Fooled by Randomness, and the latest one, which actually came out, I think, a year and a half or 2 years ago, called Anti-Fragile. And Anti-Fragile, and you'll find that when Ben and I together, we tend to recommend a lot of books to the audience. We don't assume that our audience is full of dunces and our audience is full of adults that's spelled with an O instead of a U. We make an assumption that most of you guys out there want to investigate the world, you want to find answers, why is a very important question, and you want to do some Socratic drilling. Ben and I will not talk down to you because we have high expectations for our audience. So we're always going to be throwing books out there and things like that. And what are we currently reading? Because, as Mortimer Adler would tell us, reading doesn't take place until you take your eyes off the page of the book. And what that means is that reading is an act of contemplation, reflection, interrogation of a book, and trying to discover through reading many books on the same subject and getting a more well-rounded and diverse perspective, what are the answers that fit into your own bias filters? And that's what's so interesting about The Black Swan, because it rings nicely with two books that I read during the summer, David Stockman's The Great Deformation, and another book by the author of Liar's Poker, where he talked about the 2008 financial crisis. I know that was created by the government because the government set the conditions for that very crisis to happen. 2008, by the way, that financial crisis you saw, they keep kicking the economic can down the road. That is a matter of when, not if, this alleged economic collapse is going to occur here. It will radiate out from the EU. It may radiate out from the US, but in the end, that may be a black swan event, but Taleb would tell you that the 2008 financial crisis was not a black swan event, but he would tell you that 9/11 was a black swan event. Now, I know there's a lot of people in the audience, and Ben and I both poo-poo this to a certain extent, who say, well, the government report isn't accurate, and it was space aliens, or it was reptiles, or it was other parties, not the ones that were assigned the blame for this. And that's something for somebody else to do on another show, on another program, on another network. And we're not going to cover that here today. Ben?
Correct. Absolutely correct. not that we're afraid of, you know, touching a conspiracy or whatever, because we both do believe that many conspiracies have existed over time. But we're just not going to make this a show about where we're delving into weird connections and trying to make, you know, giant leaps that there's not really a lot of evidence to support.
Well, Ben's going, as a matter of fact, Ben's going to do a very interesting thought experiment where he's going to entertain the audience with a conspiracy for which he has a mountain of evidence to prove, and that once he reveals what that is, everybody's going to say, well, I knew that. And then what I'd like to do, and either later this hour or the second hour, is I would like to discuss why I think that the rule of law is a myth. And there it is.
And that's a good teaser.
So we're not handling anything heavy today.
That's a good teaser for what's coming up. So if you're listening on the radio and you can't listen to the whole show, then afterwards, give it about an hour or so and get over to freedomfiends.com and download the show and listen to the whole thing. Because we definitely, you know, amazing stuff is going to come across this show today, and you're just going to be blown away by it. How's that?
Pass it to your friends.
Yeah, and pass it on. Make copies of it.
With BipCop.
Yeah, exactly.
Take it away, Ben.
So, so one of the things, touching a black swan again, you can't get confused about some things like Bill, you mentioned the crisis in 2008 that probably was not a black swan because there's too many indications.
Not a black swan, even according to Taleb. Yeah.
That there's just too many factors involved where it was intentional. And you can see some things like that, like, for instance, if we were to talk about the sinking of the Maine, the battleship, the Maine, that started the war between the United States and Spain. You can take this in two different directions. You can say, well, the U.S. intentionally blew the Maine up from an explosion on the inside, and there's evidence that supports that, so it's this grand conspiracy. And you can take it in that direction, but you don't have to, actually, because if it's true that the Maine had a faulty coal storage unit that caught on fire that caused the explosion, then you don't have to have a conspiracy to realize that when the event took place, when this weird, almost unpredictable event took place, then you have a lot of people in different situations that had something to gain by taking advantage of that situation. So you can look at the sinking of the Maine, even if you don't bring in conspiracies into it, you can look at the sinking of the Maine as a possible black swan because a weird event happened that very few people predicted, and then you never let a crisis I can't remember the phrase. You never let a good crisis go unused. And so people like Hearst and like people within the federal government rushed in and made accusations that this was an intentional bombing of a U.S. military, of a U.S. Navy ship, and war was fought because of that. So a black swan event can be an aspect of a bigger event like that. It can be something that is just random that then people take advantage of, or it can be a thing that happens that happens out of the blue and nobody expects. Let's say there's a EMP. Let's say the sun has a sunspot tomorrow and blows away all of our satellites around the world and leaves us without communications. That would be a black swan event that very few people are prepared for. A few people had knowledge of it. And pretty much nobody could do anything about it other than maybe, you know, shut down some satellites and try to keep them as clear of the debris field as possible as it comes through. So we have about a minute left, Bill. Did you have anything to clarify off of my ramblings there?
Well, I just want to say I do find it interesting that when you look since 1893 in our history, and both Ben and I are amateur historians and history geeks, is that if you look at 1893 with Hawaii, maritime, if you look at the Lusitania, maritime, if you look at the Maine, maritime, if you look at Pearl Harbor, maritime, if you look at the spy ship that was seized off the Korean coast, maritime, if you look at the Gulf of Tonkin with what I think was the USS Matthews, maritime, the only time that you find that the attack of an American ship, especially a ship of war, is not an act of war, is 1967 with the USS Liberty off of Israel when it was attacked by Israel.
And for some reason, U.S. didn't go to war over that.
Of course not.
We're going to step away for some market activity, but stick with us. We'll be right back.
You and the hamster in your brain are listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends.
When you shop online, please do it through the Freedom Fiends Amazon link over on the right side of freedomfiends.com. It won't cost you any extra, and the fiends will get a little taste from Amazon, and Amazon will save you the danger of drive-by stabbings at your local mall. Amazon sells pretty much everything you can buy on this earth, except for guns and weed. But they do sell the DVD Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. So get that for your gun-hating stoner brother or neocon gun nut dad. They'll thank you for it. That's freedomfiends.com. Freedom, Foxtrot, Echo, Echo, November, Sierra.com.
Freedom Fiends. And this is Ben Stone. I'm back with Bill Buppert. You know, Bill, I think we forgot to introduce ourselves during the first segment. So that's sort of a Radio Rookie 101 mistake that we did. But here on the Freedom Fiends, we point out our mistakes because, as Michael likes to say, it's a learning hospital. So we're here to not only educate others on how to do good radio, but also we learn ourselves as we go, even though we've been doing this a while now. So I am Ben Stone, and with me is Bill Buppert. Bill's website is zerogov.com, and you always find some really good stuff over there. Bill has some excellent writing. And we were chatting during the break, and we wanted to touch on some of these things that we've been talking about. The last time Bill and I were together, I had mentioned that the United States government initiated every single war that it was involved in. Now, of course, the United States government didn't exist at the time when the when the American War of Independence took place. The United States government didn't come into existence until 8 or 10 years after that war. So if you don't count the War of Independence and you only count the War of 1812 going forward, the United States government initiated every single war that it was involved in and every major, whatever you want to call them, police action or, you know, however they want to term the different activities. And like Bill was saying before the break, if you look at everyone since, I guess since Hawaii, that would be...
1893.
Yeah. So every engagement since Hawaii has been, well, not everyone. Everyone all the way up to and including Vietnam has had a naval aspect in the initiation of it and some type of a, we could also mention the difference between false flags and black swans. Because I think a lot of people confuse these two terminologies of a false flag being, it comes from the naval tendency back in the 16, 1700s. If you were a pirate or a privateer and you were on the high seas and you saw a ship with a Dutch flag, then you would put up a Dutch flag so that you could approach that ship. And you'd get right up to it, and then you'd pull down your Dutch flag, run up your black flag or whatever your other flag that you might want to use to, you know, if you wanted to blame it on the French, then you could put up a French flag. If you wanted to blame it on the English, you could put up an English flag. And then you, you know, take the prize of the Dutch ship that you've approached. So a false flag was a thing that was used in order to draw people's attentions away from the real threat so that you could initiate some type of action. That's the difference between a black swan being a random event that takes place where almost nobody could have predicted it, as opposed to a false flag where something happened that was intentional that was used to distract. So, for instance, there could, if you'd look at the Gulf of Tonkin, there could actually be some false flag and some black swan elements. If you believe that there were actually North Vietnamese gunboats that approached or fired at the Navy, the U.S. naval ships, which I don't think there really were any, but if there were, then that aspect could be an unpredictable aspect of it. But as far as I read the actual history of that, you know, the eyewitness involved said that basically they were shooting at whales. Is that your take on that, Bill?
That's my take on it. And of course, we shouldn't dip our oars too much into the conspiratorial fever swamp, to use a very tortured, you know, allegory here with what we're talking about. But the point is that, for instance, with Pearl Harbor, there's a very large amount of revisionist history, as there is right now in the last 12 years, revisionist history about Abraham Lincoln, where people are revisiting this and saying, okay, exactly what happened here? I've read Stinnett's book, Day of Deceit. I've read some other books about that. I just got my hands on a new book called Operation Snow, in which they say that there's a whole lot of Soviet involvement in the provocation. And I would urge the audience to go out there and pick up the book and give it a read. What's really compelling about that is it fills in some holes in this fabric of the Soviet intervention and use of active agents during World War II in both the UK and the US. I would urge your audience to look up something called the Venona Transcripts. I mean, the NSA even has a page on the Venona Transcripts in which it shows that there are dozens, if not hundreds, of both active Soviet agents and not so active Soviet agents who had penetrated the highest echelons of power in the United States, to include Harry Dexter White, the chief of staff.
Stick with us through the commercial and this little trip to the market, and we're going to get into more intrigue, fascination, and fun on the Freedom Fiends.
Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean. This is what radio sounds like now.
The Central Scrutinizer is a Soviet-style Leviathan trying to keep track of all you do. That's why I use a VPN, or virtual private network, from Bola VPN. Bola VPN is inexpensive, secure, and will allow you to use your computer without leaving a trail. Bola VPN is now also offering torrent seed boxes for safely sharing media with the world. And if you open a support ticket saying you heard about them from the Freedom Fiends, they'll add 3 extra days free. That's Bola VPN at BOLEHVPN.net.
Ben Stone and Bill Buepert on the radio. And so in this segment, I wanted to tell a little tale, tell a story about a conspiracy. And before you get too worried, just keep in mind that just because I use the word conspiracy doesn't mean you have to go hide under covers or shiver. Or, you know, some people will use the word conspiracy as a hammer. Like if you say in conversation, well, I think this might be like that. And then somebody will say, oh, where's your tinfoil hat? And they'll just pound you with this, you know, oh, you're just talking conspiracy theory. And they'll completely disregard everything you have to say, just based on that right. guilt by association. And it's really a pathetic argument that people throw out at you. So it's just a word. A conspiracy is a thing where more than two or more people sit down and decide, hey, let's take an action. So a conspiracy can be, let's say a corporation starts to form and you have two or three or five investors and they say, hey, let's get together and let's form this corporation. That's a conspiracy because people are conspiring together to accomplish a particular goal. And sometimes conspiracies can be a good and sometimes they can be kind of nasty. So I want to talk about a conspiracy. And to give you an idea, this conspiracy started out, it was started out entirely by private actors. Now, when I say actors, I'm going to use that phrase a couple times. I'm not talking about thespians. I'm not talking about stage actors or movie actors. I'm talking about people who were involved in the sense that they took action for the purpose of the conspiracy. So this conspiracy started out with a group of private individuals, no government involved. And they worked on this for close to a year before they got the interest of the British government of the UK. And at that time, they you know, when you're putting together a conspiracy, especially one that has the potential of being really a big deal, you don't want to like put out an ad in a newspaper or put out an ad at, you know, on Craigslist or something. Hey, recruiting conspiracy theorists, or hey, recruiting bad guys to do some evil thing. You're not going to do that. So they had to be very careful who they let in on their secret. And their secret, to start with, they gave it the code name Tube Alloys. That's what they called it, Tube Alloys. So if you walk up to someone and you weren't sure, you would say, hey, do you know about the Tube Alloys? And then you would find out if they were in on the conspiracy or not. So eventually, this conspiracy took in individuals from the UK, private individuals, and individuals from Canada. And as they worked on this conspiracy, on this plot, they found that they needed the help of the British government, of the United Kingdom, of that government. And so they were able to recruit specific individuals in the UK government to go along with them. And they needed to steal a thing from Norway. Now, just stick with me here. They needed to steal a thing from Norway, and they had conspirators in Norway that were willing to help them steal this thing. And they had to get to it quick because the Norwegian government had already said, we're going to sell this thing to this other government. So the conspirators had to act very quickly. Some of these were based in Paris and some were in London. And they had to act very quickly to get a man to Norway and literally steal away using a ship at night and get that stuff out of Norway in order to get it to England. And the guy that they recruited for this was the Earl of Suffolk. His name was Charles Howard. Okay, so by this time, this conspiracy called Tube Alloys was now an official secret of the British government and the Canadian government. But they needed more help. They needed somebody with the kind of pockets that could pay for a project like this. They needed people within the United States government. So they sent a guy all the way to the United States. This is not the kind of a thing you can pick up a phone and talk to somebody about. They sent a guy all the way to the United States, and he talked to a guy in the State Department of the United States government, and he tried to convince him how important this scheme was, how important this plan was. And the guy listened, the American guy listened to it, took the whole story in, basically had a folder with all the information in it, like a presentation, took it in, shoved it into a drawer, and left it and didn't do anything with it for almost a year. And during this time frame, the British and the Canadians were getting very frustrated because they couldn't get any response back from the Americans. So they sent another one of their co-conspirators, a guy by the name of Mark Oliphant. And Oliphant came to the U.S., walked into this guy's office, the American that they had dealt with before, and the guy admits, yeah, I didn't really do anything. The file's right there. You can have it if you want it. So Oliphant took the file, went to another American, and was able to convince that American of how important this was. So I'm going to read off some names in this conspiracy. In the UK-Canada aspect of this, we had a guy named George Lawrence. We had Mark Oliphant. We had Egan Brecher, Norman Feather, Franz Simon, Michael Clapman, and as I mentioned, the Earl of Suffolk, Charles Howard. Now, in the U.S., a guy named Ernest Lawrence was one of the primary people that figured out that this conspiracy was important and he should get behind it and he should use his considerable influence to make it happen. And so you had Ernest Lawrence, you had James Conant, you have Enrico Fermi, you have Arthur Compton, and you have George L. Harrison. And George L. Harrison was the president of the New York Life Insurance Company. So we have some people in government, we have some people in private actors, and we have some people in major industrial situations, major corporations. And so these guys plotted this thing out. And when the plot made its way to America, the name of the plot got changed. It was no longer called tube alloys. The Americans began calling it the DSM project, or the Development of Substitute Materials. That was what they called this project, Development of Substitute Materials. And you know how Americans are. They like to abbreviate everything into letters, the FBI, CIA, NSA. So they called it the DSM project. Now, for a couple years, that's what it was called, the DSM project. And literally around the world, there was maybe 35 people who knew about this. There were other people that were involved, you know, doing legwork. But as far as the inside actors that really knew what was going on, there was maybe 35 of them. Now, at one point, they actually got U.S. federal funding. And before this thing was over, when this happened and what happened, you'll know why I'm making this statement. But if you adjust the dollars for American dollars adjusted to 2015, in total, about $26 billion were spent on this conspiracy. $26 billion U.S. dollars were spent on this conspiracy, and 130,000 people were involved. This conspiracy was spread over 20 separate sites, separate locations, including three large development facilities that were built specifically for the project. All 20 sites were maintained by construction workers, janitors, plumbers, secretaries, trash collectors, electricians, and a virtual army of support personnel. And none of them knew what they were working on, or if one or two of them figured it out here or there, they either knew not to say anything about it because it was too serious and too important, and they knew that something really bad might happen to them if they were to say the wrong thing to the wrong people, or it was just too complicated for the workers themselves to figure out what they were doing. As a matter of fact, there was a woman who was essentially an operator in a factory that was working on this conspiracy, and she had a very important job running a machine, and a government photographer took a picture of her sitting in front of her machine, operating her machine, and she didn't even know the picture was taken. And almost 50 years later, in an archive situation, she saw the picture, recognized herself, and she didn't know, for 50 years, she didn't know that she had been working on that project. And the only way she knew was she saw the picture of her 50 years later. And her name, by the way, was Gladys Owens. Now, I've stretched this out, and now I'm going to drop the bomb in this story. early on, as I said, it was called the Tube Alloys Project. And then later it was called the Substitute Materials, Development of Substitute Materials Project, or the DSM Project. But then around 1940, it got its name changed to the Manhattan Project. The Manhattan Project was the project that developed the atomic bombs. And literally at the time that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Japan, according to a report by Time magazine in the same year, there were only a couple dozen people in the world who actually understood what the Manhattan Project was about. As a matter of fact, Franklin Roosevelt was president through most of the Manhattan Project, and he had been kept informed from early on this project. But his vice presidents, he had two different vice presidents during his term of office, and neither of his vice presidents were informed until it was absolutely necessary to tell Harry Truman, who then, after the death of Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman became president, and they had to sit the man down and explain to him what kind of a device that they had created. He had no idea. He'd been right there by the president's side through the war and did not know what the Manhattan Project was or what was being developed. Now, the reason I'm bringing this up is because this is a conspiracy that took place over 8 years, and at least 150,000 people were employed in the project, spending in U.S. equivalent today $26 billion, and they kept it quiet for 8 years. This is one of the things that people always say about conspiracy theories, like if you're talking about the Kennedy assassination or 9/11 or whatever the conspiracy thing that you got your mind wrapped around. They always say, how could people keep it quiet for that long? Yeah, they can. They can, and there's many ways that this can be done. And the Manhattan Project is a perfect example of that. So, there's our music. When we get back, we're going to take this in a slightly different direction, maybe. We'll see. Stick with us. We'll be right back. More with Bill, too. He's still here.
Right here. Analysts.
You're listening to The Freedom Fiends, an invigorating alternative to those other shows.
Are you sick of government lackeys who say you didn't build that? Are you tired of elitists like Barack Obama and Al Gore taking credit for the web while trying to take over the web? Are you disgusted by experts whose concept of the internet is that it's a series of tubes? Take back the free market of computing by encouraging software developers to adopt the BIPCOT NoGov license. The BIPCOT NoGov license allows any use or modification except by governments. Go to BIPCOT.org. That's Bravo, India, Papa, Charlie, Oscar, Tango.org.
Hey, there's some Squiscar Squiggles from Death Clocks. And you are listening to the Freedoms Fiends on the, you know, the radios. And I guess it says worms now. So there you go.
Tired of those old Freedom Fiends buttons? Well, the Freedom Fiends have new button designs.
As always, it's only $10 for 10 buttons, and you'll get these nifty designs. Buy sheep, for sheep, on sheep.
State speech is hate speech.
Two designs for Guns and Weed, the Road to Freedom.
Three designs for Fiend Phone.
BIPCOT No Gov.
A Freedom Fiends Worms button.
And ask me about my worms.
Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says Buttons.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
Freedom Fiends. Bill Buport, Ben Stone. I'm Ben Stone. Bill Buport's on the other end of the internet. And
that would be me.
That would be Bill. And we're going to wrap up this last hour. Bill's got a couple things from all of my ranting in the last segment. Bill's got a couple things he wanted to touch on about that. Go ahead, Bill.
I did. That was a brilliant explication of both the Manhattan Project, which is so interesting historically, and also why that is, in a lot of respects, both a correlative and a causative conspiracy theory. I wanted to mention that Cohen, Klaus Fuchs, and Harry Gold, and a number of other Soviet spies knew about this thing from the get-go and were informed on a daily basis from the get-go. And they were working on parallel developments in nuclear and atomic projects in the USSR and by the way, in Germany. I want to mention something else, too, and that's this. You mentioned the cost of this pig. When you look at World War II, which I'm fond of calling the war to save Joseph Stalin, there was another big project that cost half as much as the Manhattan Project, which was the Norden bombsite, to come up with a bombsite that could accurately drop bombs from bombers. And by the way, that's another show for us to do, is why strategic bombing against civilians is immoral through and through. And we could discuss that in another venture. But what's interesting is Malcolm Gladwell, one of my very favorite authors, he asks all the right questions. He tends to get the wrong answers, but I love his style. He's one of the most fortunate human beings in the world because he gets something that he gets an intellectual chunk out of, and he starts biting into it, and he's paid to do that so he can explore something that really trips his intellectual trigger for a year. Well, he did this 15-minute TED Talks presentation on the Norden bombsite in which he does two things really well. Number one, he talks about the history. He talks about the tremendous waste of money, the way this government program ended up being a black hole of fundage that didn't achieve what it set out to do. But number two, he shows the sheer waste of what the government did with this project, the secretive nature of the project. I mean, they had secret protocols attached to the Norden bombsite that almost matched that you saw with the Manhattan Project, except they didn't have the Soviet Swiss cheese, where everything they did at the Manhattan Project was reported to the Kremlin and the NKVD. But the Norden bombsite was still yet another example of a military-industrial complex operation that sought to do something effective, but didn't. But they spent a whole lot of money. The Venona secrets, I mentioned that in the previous segment prior to your great rendition of the Manhattan Project as a conspiracy theory. So those are things I wanted to cover. And again, I urge the audience, when you hear this stuff here, the greatest service that Ben and I can provide you is where you scratch your head and say, I'm going to go to Amazon or Abe Books or something like that, or eBay. I'm going to find some books on the subject. I'm going to read it. If we've done that, we've done a service.
Yeah, I would throw one more in there, too, that's a pet peeve of mine.
Please do.
I was so close to the project in different ways, and that is the B-1 bomber. The B-1B specifically is the one that actually finished off the process and got purchased by the U.S. government. But the B-1 bomber, I did a whole expose on this, so I won't get into it too much. But the B-1 bomber was, much like the Norden bombsite, it was one of those black holes of money that just kept it kept staying there, sucking money in, never producing what it was supposed to produce. And there was other products that were contemporaries that were far superior. But because of the political connections of the contract of the military-industrial complex that was involved in getting money for the B-1B, it just kept getting funded, and even to the point of where, it was a 1950s design that didn't go into full production until the 1980s. Now, if you think about that, that's like if you were in 1980 and someone sold you a 55 model Edsel or a 57 model Edsel. It's seriously that kind of a technological gap. And yet they were able to keep that monster alive, keep funneling money into it all that time. And eventually, getting into conspiracy theories, I have said that I believe that the attempted assassination of Ronald Reagan has something to do with that. But I won't go into that on the radio today. And I don't have anything to prove that. So therefore, that aspect would be pure conspiracy theory, which we're not going to go into.
Excellent. And the B1B suites could never talk to each other, and it turned into a program where it was the world's most expensive cruise missile tractor to move from one end of the tarmac to the other.
Yeah, a cruise missile tractor. That's perfect. Absolutely perfect. Yeah. And I can say this because I worked on the B1 project. So, haha. And so did my brother. And so did my brother-in-law.
Porcupine Freedom Festival is coming, and Robertson Roberts Brokerage has teamed up with Freedom's Phoenix and Bitcoin Not Bombs to bring you some surprises this year. Tired of the same old political promises? We're running some candidates that you can feel warm and fuzzy about wasting your vote on. This year, embrace your disillusionment by stopping by Vending Site 41 for the Vote for Nobody primary and snag key items to help you survive the wild anarchy of Porkfest. Remember, vote early, vote often, and vote harder.
Broadcasting through the Libertarian Re-Education Center's Low Orbit Ion Cannon high atop Financial Beast Plaza on the artificial satellite LibPair 2017 in the Alpha Centauri region. Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT no-gov license. This allows reuse by anyone except governments, and you can learn more at BIPCOT.org. My name is Ben Stone. I am on the Gulf Coast in the southern United States. And with me on Fiend Phone on the other side of the world in a secret undisclosed location is my co-host for today, Bill Bupert from Zero Gov. Bill, so good to have you on the phone on Fiend Phone today.
It's so great to be with you again, Ben. I'm joining you, and I have to say this, it's obligatory that you and I are philosophically terraforming the planet one disobedient surf at a time. And I am the Southwest Asia Desk Affairs Officer for the Fiends, and I'm enjoying the terraforming activities here.
And we are having a lot of fun here today. For a lot of people, talking about this kind of stuff probably is not fun. But for me, you know, Bill, talking to you about things like history and military events, crazy things like the B-1B bomber and you know, Norden bomb site. I mean, we could literally do a show on that. That's one of my favorite topics from that era, is how much money was spent and the kind of secrecy that was used on that thing, and yet then what was produced. And you know, they went to great efforts to convince people that it was almost this magical thing that you had to revere. And if you were going to crash your plane, it had a spot where you put your .45 pistol up to it and shoot into it to destroy it so the dirty Nazis wouldn't get a hold of it. It was really, the whole thing was kind of comical. But
it's just so silly. And it's just, it's one of many programs, though, that were just military disasters, like the selection of the M16, like what happened to machine gun development in the United States after the 1934 National Firearms Act and the 1938 Federal Firearms Act. And what you see is, you see a pattern there that I think is both causative and correlative, in which, because you couldn't have garage tinkerers like Mr. Browning and such doing what they wanted, it all had to be done under federal supervision. All the innovation and stuff that America had done previously in the firearms world just dissolved.
Yeah.
It just went away. As a matter of fact, only America could take the MG-34 and the MG-42, two of the finest machine guns ever produced in history, used by the Germans during the war to save Joseph Stalin, and turn that pig into the M-60. Only the Americans could do that.
Oh, man. And think of
And there's a whole host of other wasteful programs out there.
Oh, yeah. But think of the disaster of those poor guys in Vietnam that had been using the M-14. And all of a sudden, they're handed this toy, essentially, an untested toy, and said, here you go. Go fight a war with that thing.
With no chrome lining and untested, you know, to in the environment that it was employed in, right, and everything. Now, I got to tell you this, though. The M4, which is the successor to the M16 and all its AX variants, I think the until the plasma rifle comes out, the M4 is the best of breed centerfire genuine assault rifle on planet Earth. I don't think there's any better out there. We've reached a pinnacle of technological achievement with it, with direct impingement, and not the gas one that they were playing with for a while. We perfected that platform. I swear by it. You know, wherever I am, whether professionally or personally, you know, I rely on that as my liberty's teeth, if you would, if I had to go to gun.
I wish I had that luxury. I'm stuck with old, Eastern Bloc technology from the 50s. I have an SKS that I...
don't even say that. Don't even say that. Ben, you know, I consider you one of my dearest friends in the world, but now you've diminished a bit by making that. You've said that to the world. You didn't say SKS, did you?
Yeah, I did.
Look, we're gonna have to resolve that. You and I are going to get together offline. We're going to resolve that embarrassment, because you just can't do that.
Yeah,
you've got to have more pride of person.
Yeah, well, it's all a matter of funding. You know, we live a humble life. we Quakers live a humble life.
you live a humble life that is instructive to the rest of us, though, because I emulate some of the things you do, because you are Ben the Bad Quaker, and I pride myself on being a bad Quaker, but I always give you salutations whenever I say I'm a bad Quaker.
I appreciate that.
Well, Ben's
that.
The one who inspired me to do that.
Well, I have stoic
streaks. So, rule of law.
I have stoic streaks due to our conversations as well, you being my stoic
excellent.
Advisor, mentor.
Your stoic sensei.
Yeah, there we go.
Excellent. Excellent. Did you listen to my four-part series with Brett Veneau on stoicism?
I didn't get to hear the whole thing. I need to go back and download that. We were having some problems at the time, and then I forgot about it and didn't go and get the rest of it. But I need to do that. That's I like the...
It's a brilliant exposition, if I may say so myself.
Well, you may. So we wanted to talk about rule of law. I'll kind of let you take off on that.
That'll be great. And I want you to chime in when you see fit. There's a fellow by the name of John Hassness, who in 1995 penned a law review paper called The Myth of the Rule of Law. Now, I read this years ago, but I just revisited this in the past month. John Hassness is currently employed at Georgetown University as a professor. And if you look him up on the web, you'll find Hassness. He is a libertarian powerhouse when it comes to looking at the intersection between the law and liberty. And he even wrote something, Ben, that I know will be close to your heart and mine. The title of said article in a compilation was The Obviousness of Anarchy. So you can see sort of where he comes from.
Mm-hmm.
What he says about the myth of the rule of law, and I think that this is so powerful, says there could be no such thing as a rule of law that is objective and directive and can be applied to everybody in the same way every time by a government or status legal system. He says it's impossible. And I would urge your audience to go out there, because you and I plumb some deep subjects here, so I can only give the briefest of overviews on what his point is. And I'm going to illustrate it in this fashion. Those of you familiar with the Constitution, and those of you familiar with me, know that I'm something of a skeptic of that document. My Constitution would read, "And Congress shall make no law, period." Now, I could solve all the Constitution's problems with that, but that's not the case. We inherited the parchment. There are a number of Americans who worship the parchment, and our entire system of government is based on it. And I would suggest to you, as I penned in Lou Rockwell in 2009, I think it was, The God That Failed, Why the Constitution is an Inch for Big Government, I think that whatever we have today is a result of a direct design of the Constitution. So in the Constitution, we have some curious phrases in there, and these are the only things I'm going to concentrate on. I'm not going to go through the thousands of words that comprise that, nor the lesser words that comprise the Bill of Rights. I'm simply going to pick out a few key phrases, and everyone in the audience is familiar with these phrases. Everybody's sort of general welfare. Everybody's heard of it shall not be infringed. Everybody's heard of the Commerce Clause. Here's my suggestion to you that really puts the teeth in Hosness's précis that the rule of law is a myth in which it can be practiced dispassionately and in a way that serves both the citizen and the government. What you discover with the Interstate Commerce Clause is that what used to be one of my favorite presidents, and I don't have many, Grover Cleveland, he started the Interstate Commerce Commission. From that sentence, that Interstate Commerce Commission and everything that has emanated from it to include the wicked 1943 ruling of Wickard versus Filburn, which I urge the audience to explore themselves, Ben is familiar with it, from the Constitution to 1876 to 1943 to today, that Commerce Clause is probably the mother of hundreds of thousands of pages in the Federal Register and the appropriate state registers that echo that. Now, I mentioned four words, shall not be infringed. To me, the First Amendment's pretty clear. To me, the Second Amendment is pretty clear. Yet the Second Amendment, for instance, since 1934, we've had act after act after act that has got in a positivist and negative fashion on people's ability to bear arms in the United States. So what Hosness is saying, briefly, is that you cannot have a rule of law in which the state holds the monopoly on the administration of that law because they will always have political justifications for arriving at the conclusions that they do, whether they are conservatives or progressives, liberals or neoconservatives. Name your political bad actor because, as all of you know in the audience, Ben and I don't like political bad actors at all because we're both non-voters, non-party affiliated, and we think that politics is the be-all and end-all of evil on planet Earth. We think it is the root of all evil. And what Hosness is saying is that we can have the supposed dispassionate rule of law, but it doesn't exist because everything that they do has a political aspect to it. And think of politics this way. Politics is a rather neutral term that's used. And politics is part of this linguistic framework that we're trapped in as English speakers in which we say, well, politics, rather neutral, has some negative connotations, may have positive connotations. But when you strip it away, all it means is politics is that class of individuals and that class of law that allows the government to exempt itself from moral behavior by initiating force in the first place, because the entire legal system in the United States is based on the wood shampoo. Now, what do I mean when I say the wood shampoo? What I mean by that is that if you don't obey the malum prohibitum and malum in se laws that are dictated to you by the United States Code and all of the offspring that the U.S. Code has birthed within the states themselves, you're going to get a visit from some rather obese, for the most part, aggressive individuals who have badges and they have weapons, and they're going to come to you and they're going to do something. What they're going to do is this. They're going to find you, they're going to cage you, they're going to maim you, they're going to kill you, depending on your level of resistance in the process of attempting to kidnap you.
Thank you, Bill. That was eloquent, well thought out, and wonderful. And wood shampoo is where they take a stick and thump you on your head.
Thump, thump, thump.
We'll be right back, folks.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts.
Are you tired of your taxes funding endless occupations around the world? Antiwar.com is run by people who understand that wars abroad become wars at home, wars on our freedoms. Antiwar.com is dedicated to bringing you the latest in news, views, interviews, and reviews from the top movers and shakers in the anti-occupation movement. Antiwar.com has it all, from thorough foreign policy analysis to interviews with whistleblowers who used to run the military-industrial complex. Antiwar, pro-free market. That's antiwar.com.
Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts. So before the break, Bill was dropping some mad science, as Michael would say. I wanted to throw out one thing just to give it a different angle and then throw it back to Bill because I really want to hear more of that same kind of stuff. There is an old article that I read years ago. It's available over at the Mises Institute, and I will try to find a link to it for today's show notes so that when this goes up on the internet, Michael, hopefully if I can find it, Michael will put it up there, but we'll definitely put a link to what Bill is talking about as well. But there's an old article from the Mises Institute called something to the effect of the Not So Wild Wild West. And in this article, and it's a very scholarly, as a matter of fact, I would have to say that close to the first half of the article is downright boring because it is the writers are very scholarly types that are really trying to be very careful and make their point as accurately as possible, and that's sometimes boring. But once you get into the body of the article, one of the things that just really struck me and stuck with me over the years is that they point out that in the Old West, prior to the so-called law arriving, prior to the guy with the badge and what we think of with the star on his chest and whoever he is, Matt Dillon or whoever shows up, in the actual cow towns like Abilene and those very famous Old West cow towns where we're told it was so violent and everything, there was almost no violence. Until they got a sheriff. And then once they get a sheriff, then it would go from like one or two homicides a year up to, 30, 35, whatever. It would be a crazy increase. And we're told by Hollywood, oh, you have to have police, otherwise vigilante justice would do this and that and this and that. But if you actually look at the real history, committees of vigilance or vigilante groups or, however you want to derogatorily say that, and there's a good example of this that's used in this article in San Francisco, they didn't even have to form these groups until after law arrived. And once law arrived and a mayor and judges and police and all the things that come with law, once that arrived, it was so corrupt that the people themselves had to form committees of vigilance, not because their fellow citizens were so bad, but because the government, the city government, the cops, the police, the sheriff, that's why the committees of vigilance were formed. It was the citizens defending themselves literally from the cops. Okay, so I didn't really,
amen, brother.
I didn't mean to go on that long on
no,
that.
No, that's fine because I read the same article, Ben. As a matter of fact, I would also draw your audience's attention to Ryan McCracken's book, McCracken or McCacken, I hope I'm not mispronouncing his name. But it's called Commie Cowboys, where he talks about cowboy cinema.
Yeah.
And the way with cowboy cinema it's such that, well, it's all about the gun. Well, it's not all about the gun because if there's anything that's representative in cinema of the real West, it's Little House on the Prairie, where peaceful dispositions and commerce and all those kind of things, that's what tamed the West, not the gun. Now, back to Hosness, I wanted to quote something out of his article that really struck me, and there was a lot out of his article that really struck me. And I quote, "For with the acceptance of the myth of the rule of law comes a blindness to the fact that laws are merely the commands of those with political power and an increased willingness to submit oneself to the yoke of the state." Now, what's really exciting about Ben is you and I have been talking for a while. We've been friends for a while. And I remember several shows back where I said that police are the pointy end of all politics.
Right.
And this system is what the police deliver people onto because police are simply looking for candidates for the gulag.
Mm-hmm.
That's their primary occupation. Their occupation isn't protect and serve. Their occupation is punish and suppress. And that continuum of assuming room temperature that I was talking about earlier. By the way, I think that we're at 500 this year of American citizens murdered. I would tell you that number of them include what has occurred in the American gulag system because we have no record of that whatsoever. And the American gulag system, except for I think 5% of it, is a state gulag system from state to the federal level. Own a fully owned subsidiary of the federal government, so they're all government employees. Much like when Ben and I would find ourselves in a court of law, unless we retained a defense attorney, we're the only non-government employee standing in there.
Yeah.
Everybody, to include the guy wearing the silly robe, is a creature of the state. I want to briefly go over malum prohibitum, malum in se. Malum in se is where you and I say that theft of property, murder, rape, those kind of things are bad. Universally, most people know in their genetic wiring, call it natural rights, call it a priori, whatever the case may be, that's wrong.
We're going to get back to that right after this trip to the market. And Bill's going to drop some more mad science on you. Stick with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum.
The Michigan Peace and Liberty Coalition is proud to present the 3rd Annual Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest. It will be held at the Circle Pine Center in Delton, Michigan from August 7th through the 10th. There will be vending, discussions, presentations, all sorts of activities for children and adults, and bacon, lots of bacon. Round up your friends and family and get them registered today at miplc.org. That's miplc.org. Dogs welcome. Longer leashes recommended.
Freedom Fiends, my name is Ben Stone. With me is Bill Buppert from ZeroGov. And we are Freedom Fiends. We are pouring hot molten truth into your ear hole to scald out all the silliness and bad education that the state has washed your brain with over the years. How's that, Bill?
Indeed. I love it. So I was talking about malum in se, and malum prohibitum is where the government says, well, we don't like illegal vegetation, so we're going to make it illegal. Because remember that licensing is this. The essence of licensing is where the government says, if you pay us a fee, we'll allow you to do something we've deemed illegal. But if you give us some grif, we'll allow you to do it in certain respects. But the rule of law, and I got two more quotes here from Hosnes' article. And if the audience members are interested enough, it will be in the show notes. This is astonishing to me. And I quote, "But the myth of the rule of law does more than render the people submissive to state authority. It also turns them into the state's accomplices in the exercise of power." Now, Ben and I have drilled this into the audience's heads for years and at Porkfest and places like that, which is that the state has this almost eerie power not only to convince you that your shackles make you free, but to make you turn in your neighbor to the authorities if they don't think and behave the way the state expects them to do. Now, of course, this leads to violence because political science, politics, is all about violence. Lou Rockwell says this eloquently. I'm paraphrasing. He says, all this is about is the application of violence in society and whether it's initiated or not. Because as Ben and I are fond of saying, immoral means cannot possibly yield moral ends. And that is sheerly a political calculus. So he goes on to talk about British colonial rule, and this is my last quote from here. And he says, "It is difficult to understand this behavior on the part of the highly moralistic, ever so civilized British." He's talking about the beatdowns and wood shampoos of Gandhi and his salt tax rebellion that he had. "Unless one keeps in mind that they were able to view their activities not as violently repressing the indigenous population, but as upholding the rule of law. How many times have you heard your friends, family, and neighbors say, well, that person deserved the beatdown they got because somebody's got to make sure the law is upheld? There was recently a Texas community pool that was invaded supposedly about by a number of people who were uninvited, and a cop ended up laying on, handcuffing, and applying some really excessive force to a 14-year-old teenage girl in a bikini and doing very inappropriate stuff with this young girl on both a concrete sidewalk and the grass. He has since resigned from that position." What all this ties together, it's almost a metastasized system in which the legal system, the police authorities, and the politicians are all in cahoots, and naturally they are, to say, we have the state monopoly on violence, and if you don't stay within this narrow framework of the behavioral norms that we, as the U.S. government and all of its satraps in the states, want you to do, we will apply the wood shampoo. We will use violence. As a matter of fact, we may kidnap you and put you in a cage if we don't end up killing you, but that's the price of civilization. And I'm quoting them, not myself, because to me, they are barbarism.
Yeah. And they have a vested interest to keep this system going. That's something also that a lot of people don't realize. You think about, oh, well, the cops are just here to keep the peace. They're just here to make sure you're safe. No, they're not. They're here to perpetuate their job and to protect the jobs of other people in government that are all part of a parasitic system that feeds off of the rest of us. It's all just a process to feed the parasite. That's all it really is.
You know what? Who would pay their taxes if they didn't know they'd end up in a cage to pay them? I mean, even progressives.
Yeah.
Are there progressives out there say, well, you know what? Bernie Sanders, by the way, I'm a non-voter, full disclosure, but Sanders Clinton 2016, if we could put Cthulhu on there, I think it'd be a perfect ticket. But Sanders is perfect to me. I love it when he talks about this 91% tax on the wealthy. And I think to myself, Bernie, you're not going far enough. Be logical here. $15 minimum wage, $150 minimum wage.
Yeah.
91%, it should be 120% tax on the wealthy, where I want you to give up everything, but I want you to have a garage sale, too, to make up for the 20%. I want you to sell all your stuff, because I'm the government, and I'm telling you how to dispose of what you have. And by the way, that means all the wealthy are on the same plantation that everyone else is.
You know, I often use the comparison of, I compare government to air. And you walk around in your daily life, and you don't think about breathing, you don't think about air, because it's always there. But you don't really notice air until you can't get air. And the moment that you can't get air, the one thing in life that becomes more important than anything else is air. And freedom is a lot like this. We walk around, and if we're not being crushed by the government, if we don't physically feel the boot on the back of our neck, if we don't have that cop with his knee between our shoulder blades driving our face down into the pavement, if you don't feel that, you don't notice the government. If you don't have to go and stand in line at the DMV for 2 hours, well, they finally get to you and they tell you, you don't have the right form, you got to start back over again. If you don't do that, you never feel the government. So in a very real sense... Go ahead, yeah. Bill. Oh, go ahead, Bill.
It's a neem roller thing, too. First they came for the bikers.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what's going on right now. First, they came for the pot smokers. First, they came for the people who are selling tangerines in California under a certain diameter that is prohibited by the government.
Right.
First, they came for the raw milk. First, they came for...
lemonade stands.
I mean, you just put something nonsensical there. And it goes on and on and on, and people just say, well, that's the price of civilization. No, you know what that is? It's the price of barbarism.
Right.
Because that's what government is. Government is barbarism, because barbarism is this equation. Immoral means yield moral ends. That's barbarism.
Yeah. Yeah, and really, if you have to wait until it's so late, you know, using a Larkin Rose's example, if you wait until you're in the cattle car and they're slamming the doors shut, you've waited too long. You have to figure out at what point prior to that do you say, you know what, I think maybe I'm not getting in a cattle car. If you wait until that point, you've waited too long. So where is that balance? I have no idea. We can't even explore that balance at this point in time. Go ahead.
Well, it's brilliant that you bring that point up, Ben, because what it does is it speaks to this alleged First Amendment protection that you and I have, because you and I are prohibited from even contemplating and sharing on the air what a possible solution is to the oppression that we are suffering that makes King George III look like a doddering rooster chicken.
That's true. That is absolutely true. You know,
I mean, what the colonists suffered under George III is nothing compared to what weighs upon us today.
If my grandfather, I say this pretty regularly too, if my grandfather, he liked to travel. My grandfather liked to travel. He was a railroad man all his life. And after he retired, he liked to get on, you know, railroad and travel around the country, he and my grandmother. And my grandfather had he been in a TSA checkpoint, and they would have done to my grandmother what they routinely do in TSA checkpoints today just to travel from one city to another in America, my grandfather would have taken actions that I can't even mention on the radio, and he would probably have suffered either in life in prison or been shot down on at the spot, one way or the other. He would not have tolerated TSA agents or any of these other government goons manhandling his wife. That would not have taken place. But the American people have gotten accustomed to it. You know, the strangulation has been slow. It's not always that boot in the back of your head. It's not always the foot in your chest. Sometimes it's just, well, you can have your lemonade stand. You just have to pay a $300 license to have it.
That was incredible to me that happened recently. And I think, once again, I look at that lemonade stand story the same way I look at every time I'm traveling on the highway and I pass by somebody who's been pulled over by a road pirate and they're getting the usual treatment by the cockroach. And I think to myself, look, another convert. and that's probably what happened with the lemonade stand. I'm hoping that hundreds, if not thousands, maybe tens of thousands of people saw this and said, wow, that what's going on? What happened?
Yeah.
You know, 1984, it was a novel, not an instruction manual, but the government's confused.
Yeah, in that sense, and I'll ruffle some feathers here, but I've said this so many times. In that sense, you know, a lot of us in our way of thinking that recognize freedom and want freedom, a lot of us will say, oh, well, I came into this by reading, you know, Ron Paul's stuff or hearing him make a speech or whatever. But I would argue
sooner for me.
Yeah. But I would argue that in most cases, the explosion in the desire to have freedom in the last 15 years has taken place at least as much, if not more, from the growing oppression of government, from guys like George W. Bush and Barack Obama, whose feet stink and he's a socialist and a liar. Those guys, in my mind, have done as much to push the agenda of the desire of freedom than Ron Paul or, you know, some of the great Hans Hermann Hoppe or Murray Rothbard or you mentioned Lysander Spooner. Those guys were great academics that really did some serious thinking and broke some ground into areas that others haven't delved into. But I think if the George W. Bushes and the Barack Obamas and the Bill Clintons, and if those guys weren't there trying to strangle us all the time, I don't think we would have sought the Lysander Spooners and the Murray Rothbards. What do you think about that, Bill?
You know, that may very well be the case. It's interesting. I do think that there's an inner yen in a certain percentage of population for freedom from oppression. For instance, my saintly bride, Lilo, is one of those people who, she may not have had, she's real smart, but she didn't have the intellectual interest in pursuing Spooner, Rothbard, Mises, and all the rest of it. But she had that sort of genetic repulsion of authority where she just thought, and she's got red hair and she's a Celt, and I think that contributes to it. But probably that authority would not enjoy if they got on the bad side of her. So there's two types. I think there's folks out there who have arrived at it intellectually. And then I think maybe this is the majority of them, Ben, folks who say, you know what, that just ain't right treating folks like that. There's something wrong with that person's moral compass. They may have a badge and they may wear a robe, or they may be in a political office and be referred to as honorable, which is laughable, but there it is.
I agree. Folks, stick with us. We're going to head out to the market one last time and then come back with Redemption in the Third Act on the Freedom Fiends.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and some of his weird friends. And yes, we're broadcasting this into space.
Are you sick of peaceful people being locked away for victimless crimes? Instead of trying to get out of jury duty, consider taking it so you can do the right thing. A single juror with a conscience can send someone home to their family instead of to a jail cell. If there's no victim, how can there be a crime? And if the judge or prosecutor are keeping you in the dark, what are they trying to hide? You can vote your conscience instead of being a pawn of the state. For more information, Google jury nullification or check out the Fully Informed Jury Association at fija.org.
This show survives on donations from fiends like you. We put that money back into our show and Liberty Outreach and donate most our ad space to Liberty organizations that make a difference. We're also a teaching hospital, educating the next generation of Liberty talkers on the skills needed to keep the radio flame of truth burning into the future. Put your money where your heart is and make a donation of any amount to the Freedom Fiends. Please go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post.
Freedom Fiends on the radio. You know, Bill, during the break, brought up a really interesting thing to think about. You know, when you're on the internet, when you have an internet-only show, which is what I did with my Bad Quaker podcast for a long time, and Bill has his website of zerogov.com, and when you're doing stuff on the internet, and it's only on the internet, it's not hard to figure out the statistics. Now, they're not exactly perfect. You don't. There's no real perfect statistics for a website. It's all kind of fuzzy math. But you can get an idea. You know, you can see so many downloads going to China, so many downloads going to Australia, so many to, you know, Germany or whatever. And you can kind of get an idea of the number of hits that are coming onto a website, if the popularity is growing, if it's shrinking or whatever. But on the radio, you don't have that. We don't. It's impossible to know how many people are turning this radio show on for the first time in their car, driving to the 7-Eleven or whatever, and hearing us and going, wait a minute, what is this thing I'm hearing? It's just something that we have very little feedback. One way, listeners, one way you can give us feedback is to go to freedomfiends.com, freedomfiends.com. And about an hour or so after each show, the show goes up on the website in an archive form, and you can ring in there and give comments to it. So that's one way we can get feedback. But it's very difficult to know how many new listeners we have, how many are listening radio only, 30-some radio stations across the country.
And we especially like comments that disagree with us.
Yeah. Sometimes I get a little rough with commenters, but if you can look past my roughness, I'm generally kind of playful in them at some point in time.
Not only does he look like a panda in certain respects, he's got the heart of a panda. That's Ben Stone.
I wonder if you can provoke a panda.
So redemption in the third act, here we are.
Oh, yeah.
I think you could. If you took its bamboo away from it, I'll bet you could.
You know,
you take food away from practically anything. Have you ever heard a porcupine speak?
I don't think I've ever heard.
I'm dead serious. I did not know this until a week ago. A porcupine is the mascot of the Free State Project, and I would urge everybody to YouTube a porcupine that lives in New Hampshire where they're feeding it either corn or something else. I never knew that porcupines vocalize the way this porcupine does. I think his name is Teddy. He's the cutest thing you've ever seen. I love animals, and yeah, check it out and see what you think. So this is a redemption of third act, right?
Yeah. So he's a chattery little guy, huh?
He's a chattery little guy. He's the cutest creature. You know, a civilization is judged in the way it treats its innocents, which means, in the case of you and I, our concern for the unborn, being opposed for the death penalty, and taking care of animals, because you and I are very fond of animals. I think there's very few things that you can do as a man or a woman. You could be a child. You could be a teenager. You could be an adult. Then treat animals well. If you're doing that, I think you're doing right, and I think karma is going to come around. And I'm not saying karma in the spiritual sense. I use the word karma in a more secular sense because I really believe that the more good stuff I do, the more times I'm kind, the more times that I'm really laid back and tranquil, and I genuinely try to make other people's lives better by serving my own self-interest, I think it comes around. And I think it comes around through the sheer frequency and multiplicity of the time that you're doing that, that eventually someone's going to say, oh, look, Bill needs help, or Ben needs some consoling, or whatever the case may be. He did a good turn by me. I'm going to do a good turn by him, because morally, as ANCAPs, abolitionists, anarchists, whatever you want to refer to us as, we believe in the non-aggression principle. We believe in the zero aggression principle, which Rothbard did some very eloquent arguments in favor of and described all ends. And wow, it works. So I do think karma is real.
I think so. You know, if you plant a seed, and this is almost a biblical thing, but if you plant a seed and you germinate that seed and care for it correctly, it will grow into the thing that you have planted. You don't plant corn and grow potatoes. The thing that you sow, you reap. And without that going into a big spiritual thing, I believe exactly what you just said, Bill. It's an aspect of just being a human being on this planet. If you're doing the right stuff and you're doing good and you're trying to help your fellow man, it's got to come back and help you back in some way. There's a reciprocal process there. Not necessarily magical.
Annelids, brother.
Hey, Bill, thanks a ton for coming on the show with me today. It's great, as always, to talk to you.
I feel the same, Ben. Always an honor to be with you.
Folks, be sure and get over to, I almost said badquaker.com. No, get over to Freedom Fiends and download the show and share it with your friends.